decision?
We're all.
It is. Okay. Call to order the meeting of the House Committee on Business and Labor from November 20th, 2013. And we welcome you all back for our couple of days of interim meetings. And I know that Representative Matthews is not here yet, but I would like to, he's not no longer just Representative Matthews, he is now also the interim fire chief for the city of Gresham.
Does that mean he can wear his uniform?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
He's going to be so happy.
You have to call him chief, do we?
Yes, you must call him Representative Chief now.
So. I think it's the Honorable Representative
Honorable
Chief.
Representative Chief, yes. Thank you very much for the protocol confirmation, clarification on that. Okay, today we have interim hearings on various items. And the first one that we're going to start out with, because we've got some representatives and senators that have other committee obligations, is an update on the earned sick leave work group. And so if I can call up Senators Elizabeth Steiner-Haywood and Representative Jessica Vega Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Jessica Vega Peterson. I'm a state representative for House District 47, which is in East Portland. Thanks so much for the opportunity to testify today to bring you up to speed on the work that we've been doing in an earned sick leave work group that Senator Steiner-Haywood and I have been co-chairing. So we have put together a group of folks to build on the work that was done in the last session to see if we can come to some consensus on paid sick leave and how we can move forward in Oregon with that. We had a group of 12 people in the work group itself. We had folks from the healthcare, from unions, from business and labor, as well as other representatives. Representative John Davis and Senator Hansel were part of this group as well. We met once a week for about 6 weeks, and we worked through the last bill section by section to see where we were in agreement and where we had points of contention. And then Senator Steiner-Haywood and myself, after we had these discussions, we met and spoke one-on-one with folks to see where we were and if we were in a point to move forward.
So, for the record, Elizabeth Steiner-Haywood, State Senator from District 17, Northwest Portland, Beaverton area. As Representative Vega Peterson pointed out, we worked very hard to make this a broad, diverse group. We had quite a range of representation, people who came in adamantly opposed, people who came in, this needs to happen no matter what, and a bunch of people in between. We divided the content up into several different areas. For example, should there be a lower limit on the size of a business that would be subject to these regulations? How many hours total per year should be required to should be allowed to accumulate. For smaller business, should we require that if they don't have to provide paid sick leave, that they could provide protected, uncompensated sick leave? Should there be exceptions for certain kinds of businesses that have unusual circumstances? And I'll describe those in a moment. What should be the waiting period before these benefits could be used? Could the benefits roll over from 1 year to the next? How could they or should they be paid out? And a range of questions like that. We went into the work group not necessarily expecting to get to consensus, because we knew that might be difficult, but certainly hoping that whatever we came out with would be better than what we went in with, because we'd had an open, respectful conversation. And I don't know if any of you saw the article in the Oregonian about, just less than a week ago, I think that it was presented pretty accurately, and if you ask members, for example, Jan Meekums from NFIB has said quite openly that she's very comfortable with the process, doesn't agree with the outcome per se, but we didn't expect that, but she does feel, and AOI feels, for example, that they were heard loud and clear, and that there were changes made that were reflective of their concerns. So we're very happy about that part of the process. Ultimately, at the moment, what we've come down with are some changes to the bill that we were working off of last year. And we've done, one other thing I would make clear is that throughout we've done everything we can to line up the language with other employment law around the books. And we've been fortunate to have representatives from BOLI there to help us make sure that the regulatory language matches up as much as possible. The time periods match up, that the way things are described, posting requirements, whatever they are. The last thing we want is for employers to have to follow lots of different nuances of the same concept. So we're trying very hard to make sure things line up as evenly as possible. We made changes that reflected how do we describe a year, for example, because instead of saying a calendar year, because for some people it's your anniversary date, we tried to give as much flexibility as possible. And at this point, we've reached, I would say, a strong majority opinion about the language that might work, but certainly not consensus. NFIB and AOI still have concerns. The Restaurant and Lodging Association has gotten to the point where, with certain modifications, they may be okay with at least staying neutral, but we haven't committed themselves yet. But they feel very comfortable with the changes that we've made in the process. We would continue to, as Portland has done, exempt certain labor unions that have a very specific hiring hall and administer all their benefits through their hiring hall, because members of those unions tend not to work for one employer. They tend to have employers who pay into that benefit pool. Building and construction trades are a really good example of that. The stagehands are trying, I don't know if the carpenters do something similar to that at all, but probably the same kind of situation there. So those would not, those employers, if they were hiring entirely union labor working through those hiring halls, would not be, would be exempted from this requirement. They wouldn't have to provide additional sick leave because that wouldn't be fair to employers. Other unions that choose to organize in that way may be eventually able to. Overall, the consensus is that were a statewide policy to be enacted, that it would likely preempt any local regulations. There might be some concern about workers who already have benefits, for example, in Portland, to make sure that they didn't lose benefits that they already had, and we'd have to work out the nuances of that. But generally speaking, the group was in agreement that having a patchwork of regulations around the state wasn't good for anybody. It wasn't good for business, certainly, and we didn't think it was good for workers either, because they should know their rights no matter where they're working, and they should be uniform rights around the state. So we've reached a reasonable sense that there's probably going to, there would be a waiting period of probably 90 to 120 days before the benefits could take effect, although employers could certainly allow them to be used prior to that time. People could accrue the hours prior to that time but just not use them. That we would probably be looking at a minimum business size of 6, but with the opportunity for protected unpaid time for smaller businesses, and probably looking at somewhere between a maximum of 40, a minimum of 40 to 56 hours a year of accumulated time to allow for serious illnesses if those came up. Certainly, if an employer had a paid leave policy that was a flexible one, some employers choose to do a total paid time off, and employees can use it for whatever they choose. And we would not want them to have to suddenly divide that into 40 hours of sick leave and 40 hours of vacation. They could continue, as long as workers could use up to that amount for sick leave, that would be their choice. We don't want to regress in worker benefits in the way we do this.
And I think that was one of the things that for the work group and the Senator and I were in agreement on. We wanted to be as flexible as possible for existing policies that are working well for employers and working well for employees, that are giving them the benefits that are the spirit of the legislation that we were reviewing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So we're happy to go into more detail. We have not yet decided whether we're going to proposed legislation in the February session. We're still working with a range of stakeholders, including other legislators, to determine if there's interest in trying to move this February, and if so, what the best path might be. But that's an open discussion. We'd be very interested in any input that any of you have to offer on that, and happy to answer any other specific questions.
Okay. Are there any questions? Representative Freeman.
Thank you. Representative Holy might have had his hand up first, but...
No, go ahead. Okay. I'll go second.
Great. Thank you, Lynn. Thank you for being here today and working on this issue. I know it's something you're both very passionate about. So I got just a few questions. One, in your work group, did you have anybody that was unemployed?
Anybody that was unemployed?
Unemployed. Somebody looking for a job as part of your work group.
I don't believe we did.
Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, no, we didn't.
You may consider, as you move forward, talking to those folks that would love to have any job, whether it had benefits or not. That's just something you might want to think about.
It's a great idea. Thank you.
And then as you're talking about trying to provide benefits for those that work for private businesses here in Oregon, is there any thought, since the state's actually talking about mandating this cost on businesses, to offsetting that cost with a tax credit? It's really that good of an idea. Maybe we ought to think about, from a state level, paying for it. So you might give that some consideration moving forward, too.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. We haven't had those discussions yet, and really when we were talking about the why we need this policy, we are looking at it from the public health perspective and ways that this would help in a broader sense of you know, saving some of the health care costs. That was one of the things that came up for discussion. Also, there was the sense of we're looking at this as, you know, a policy of just a fair worker benefit, just like we have a minimum wage and we don't compensate businesses for minimum wage. So, you know, would we consider compensating for this? It's an interesting question that hadn't been part of the discussion.
Just a couple mm-hmm. more real quick. Thank you. I heard you talk a little bit about business size. Was there any discussion about a trigger? So, like, say the state's unemployment rate is at a certain rate. If it matches the federal or below, maybe it triggers and goes into effect. I'm worried about people not getting jobs where I'm from, and you guys seem more worried about the benefits that they have. So that's maybe something to consider so that we're not causing additional unemployment with this. I mean, I kind of jokingly mentioned to Representative Barton that, you know, even you talked about a business size of six, it means I got to get rid of a couple people at my business because I'm over that. So it's just, you know, I kind of was joking when I said that, but you might want to think about creating additional unemployment. And then you talked about the paid personal leave. A lot of us just say, you know, vacation, sick leave, it's just, this is what you get. And you were contemplating that qualifying. So a lot of folks
yes.
that do both vacation and sick leave could just call it all one thing. And
yep.
Okay, that's very good. I like that concept.
Yep.
And you also might think about county size. Some of the rural counties, Curry County, Josephine County, they have very high unemployment rates. And anything you do that's going to cost employers more is likely to cost jobs. So you may think about that also as your discussion goes forward. And again, thank you for being here.
Okay. Thank you for your thoughts.
Thank you, Representative Freeman. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Ed. And my question will go directly to the, I guess, the concepts and the language that you might be working on in regards to the flexibility with multi-employer situations with, you know, people who use hiring halls and that sort of thing, because there are a lot of different models of how they deal with vacation and sick leave, and so I'd really be interested in seeing that or sharing those concepts so that I can, you know, weigh in on that perhaps before you finalize a proposal.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. We were working directly from the Section 10 in the previous bill, and that language was fairly solid, I think, as far as what we were using. And we were just kind of, if we were talking about anything, it would just be tweaks to that. But you can refer to that as what the discussion was.
And if I may, Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, we also looked at the language that had been negotiated as part of the Portland regulations mm-hmm. and how that was worked out to identify unions that have very specific practices. We are very open, as I hope we're making crystal clear, to as much input as anybody is inclined to offer. So if you, we're very happy to share the current language with you, Representative Holvey, and look forward to any input that anybody can offer.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions, comments? Okay, thank you very much. I thank the committee for their work. And maybe we'll see you in February. Maybe we'll see you in another 8 months.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you,
Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay. I see. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay, the next thing on the agenda, we do have a new director of the Oregon Employment Division. So, and actually she was here the last time we met, but had not been confirmed. So I'd like to introduce Lisa Niesenfeld from the new director of the Employment Division, and just here to give a little background, and if you have any questions or comments or anything, welcome very much to the state. Welcome to the state of Oregon and our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Niesenfeld, and this is about my eighth week of work. So I'm excited to be back in Oregon and heading up the Employment Department. I have about a 30-year background in workforce development as well as economic development, and come to the job looking to help spearhead a significant amount of change in the Employment Department and in the way that we handle workforce development in the state of Oregon as a whole. We, as you know, are responsible for unemployment insurance as well as getting people back to work as quickly as possible. We will be going around the state in March through May to talk in different parts of the state how the different strategies we use in different areas need to vary. So we believe that what is needed in Pendleton is probably significantly different than what is needed in Portland, and we want to make sure that we can address those needs. The tools we use were principally invented in 1933 when the Employment Service was invented. We think it's time to update our strategies and approaches and see if we can add more value to the employment enterprise in Oregon. We look forward to working very closely with local workforce investment boards as well as our local community colleges in doing that.
Thank you. Would you like to give us a little background as to, we know that you work in economic development and so on, but a little more specifics maybe?
Most recently, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I was the president of the Columbia River Economic Development Council in Clark County, Washington. That gave me a great perspective on what it's like to not be in the big city of the state. Mm-hmm. Because in Washington, everything is about the Puget Sound. Mm-hmm. And so that was fascinating. And it was a very interesting job to see how reliant economic development is on workforce these days. 10 years prior to that, I was the executive director of the Workforce Development Council for 3 Southwest Washington counties. Prior to that, I worked for the Portland Development Commission in that sort of intersection between workforce and economic development, helping the region fill the jobs created through economic development and also doing target industry strategies. And my workforce days go all the way back to CETA, mm-hmm. both in the government sector. I've also worked in the private sector. I've had my own company doing training. So it's a subject close to my heart, and I have a lot of passion to make sure that at this time when the baby boom is retiring, that we find ways to make sure that we have the skills we need in the workforce.
Okay, great. Well, we're very, very glad that you're here. Do you have any comments or questions for Director Niesenfeld? Yes, Representative Kinnamer.
Thank you. Congratulations. Nice to have you here, and had the opportunity to meet with you and a couple of other people on Monday, and found that very informative. I guess as I've been reflecting on that, you know, it's interesting to have a program that works pretty well. Our unemployment program works pretty well. It's been well funded. It's at reasonable levels of cost. It just really hasn't been very carefully examined for a modest 75 years or more. And I think that an update is very appropriate, and I think, you know, we're doing well, and it's kind of neat to look at maybe we can do even better. So I guess that's more by way of comment than anything else, and be watching this carefully, because I think those are the goals, to do better.
Yes.
Great. Thank you very much. Any other questions, comments? Okay. Welcome to Oregon.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, and feel free to come to the committee anytime. Thank you. With this one too. Okay. The next thing at 8:25 in the morning, we are going to have a presentation on the state of the wine industry and the marketing goals for the Oregon Wine Board. And we have Tom Danowski and Dan Jarman.
Task force, the business task force. We have samples. We may come talk to you.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. A little early for
Where
samples.
Where is the tasting?
We
should see if the product is really as good as they say. Of course, we haven't heard that they've said it's good.
What's the thing? It's 5 o'clock.
Madam Chair, maybe while they're talking about technology, here, I can do a quick little intro. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dan Jarman, representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association. Wanted to introduce you to Tom Danowski, who has been on the job almost 2 years. This is the first time he's had a chance to come to this committee and meet with you. Tom wears two hats. He's the director of the Oregon Wine Growers Association, which is the advocacy and legal arm for the wine industry, but also heads the Oregon Wine Board, which is the semi-independent state agency that's in charge of all the marketing, promotion, research, and education for the wine industry. And we're very, very fortunate to have Tom, someone with his expertise and experience in the marketing and brand promotion world. He has worked for big and prestigious entities such as Chateau St. Michel in Washington, Coca-Cola, Kraft Foods in New York City, Cutter & Buck, and has also consulted other major companies like Microsoft and REI on branding and marketing. So we're very, very honored to have him working with our wine industry. He's a native Oregonian, grew up in Beaverton, is a graduate of the University of Oregon. He would love to talk to you about the Ducks, but today's subject is the state of the Oregon wine industry. Tom Danowski.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thank
Welcome.
You. And thank you for this invitation. It's probably a rare chance to talk about something that we live and breathe every day, and we're just really excited to get a chance to fill you in. We're I'm joined by Jana McCamey from the Oregon Wine Growers Association, and we're here to give you an update on what's been going on in the wine business in the 10 years since the Oregon Wine Board was founded by legislation. But just to give you a little bit of a background, I'm speaking today on behalf of about 900 wine growers. We call them wine growers when they produce the fruit that's made into wine, another 545 wineries around the state. So we have a business that is thriving. I'm also here representing my team of six people back in our Portland office and our board of directors of nine. And it's just a really great chance to come here and to thank you for the support that you give our thriving industry in issues that pop up like the wine growler or the land use issue or things like Oregon Wine Month or the license plate program. It goes on and on, but your support has made a tremendous impact on the health of our industry. And I have some information here I wanted to share with you and hopefully anticipate some of the questions that you probably get when you go around the state and around the world, like why aren't our wines perhaps more easily found, or what's going on in Washington that we might learn from here in Oregon. So I'd like to go ahead and touch on some of those things for you and try to move us along. As you can see, we're on the 10th anniversary of the Oregon Wine Board founding, and our primary charter deals with enological, viticultural, and economic research to try to advance the industry. And in fact, it's really kind of an interesting metaphor what's going on in the wine business. I mean, Oregon for decades has really been based to a large degree on sort of a natural resource extraction type economy, and as our economy rebalances, it's really a phenomenal spotlight shining on the wine business. We're really an example, as are our colleagues in the craft beer and even the craft distilling business, but specifically to the wine business, we're a great example of the power of premium-priced, consumer-branded, value-added agriculture products that not only revitalize a lot of parts of our state, rural and metropolitan communities, but boy, they are just fantastic ads for Oregon when we all go around the world. There's nothing better than to put a great bottle of Oregon wine on the table when you're with friends and talking to people from around the world. We're really fortunate to be able to work in that business. Our board of directors is comprised of nine people from around the state. They're an interesting group of people that bring a diverse experience set from vineyards and wineries, from small enterprises to mid-sized to very large enterprises. And they're, of course, appointed by the governor, and their expertise and their consultation with me and my team is one of the reasons why we're thriving. just to give you a flavor of what's been going on, Oregon has built on a foundation of pioneering spirit, and really that's no more true than in some of the wine pioneers who came here, you know, 60, 70 years ago and started doing grape farming when a lot of their friends said they ought to have their heads examined. There was no way that this was ever going to work. And, of course, the history of winemaking in Oregon goes way back, even before that, but sort of the modern era of Oregon winemaking really starts about six decades ago. And what has happened now is Oregon wines are esteemed throughout the world far in excess of the kind of acreage that we have as a share of the world's total, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about that. It's also one of the reasons why you're seeing in your headlines an accelerated level of investment in the Oregon wine business from people in France, from people in Washington State, from California. There's a discovery here going on that continues that's really generating a lot of interest. You look across the industry and you go back over the decades and you see some of the pioneers in this picture that have shaped this industry. Luckily, I think we've gotten to be a little bit snappier dressers since the time this was taken, but there's no way to overestimate the power that some of these early pioneers had on shaping the values of our business. I'm going to press ahead and touch on just a couple of things. I know you're tight on time, but to give you a...
We've got plenty of time.
Okay, good. Let me start with just kind of a dashboard to give you a sense of our metrics in our business over the last decade. I'll let you study that for a sec.
Quite a bit of growth.
Quite a bit of growth. And again, I don't want to underestimate at all the role that the legislature, the governor, have played in this, as well as the wine community. You can see the growth that takes place both on the vineyard side and on the winery side. Of course, when I say wineries, I'm also talking about a community of many of them grow their own grapes and make their own wine. The other 900 are largely involved in making grapes and selling them to wineries, but they absolutely need each other. And
Representative Borton has
please,
a question
right ahead.
For you. If you. Do you mind if we have questions
go
for
right
the presentation?
Ahead.
So, thank you, by the way. Thank you for coming in.
Sure.
So when I look at that slide, you look at, you know, approximately, you know, 2x growth in 9 years. It's impressive. That's actually not that uncommon with a lot of commodities when demand gets up and price gets high. But that's why there's a cyclical nature to the price of most commodities, especially if there's low barrier to entry, like coffee, for example. When prices get high, a lot more gets planted, price collapses, and it shrinks again, right? In order for this to work, in order for the price to remain stable, which I think it has, if not somewhat appreciated, that means that demand has for Oregon wine has grown greater than 2x. Is that sustainable?
Well,
either price is going to collapse or demand's going to keep accelerating. But eventually, something's got to give.
Sure, that's a great question, Representative Barton. It's a fundamental economic tug of war. I think there's a couple things that contribute to the perspective I might offer. Sort of from a macro sense, we're entering a period where our country, and certainly the world, but certainly in this country, demographics are moving dramatically in our favor. As baby boomers continue to age into those years when disposable incomes rise, it's a fantastic time to be making wine in the price segments that Oregon thrives in. Mm-hmm. So the demand side of the equation is relatively solid, provided we can continue to deliver the quality. The Oregon farming environment for wine grapes is such that because of our cooler climates, we tend to get slightly lower yields than some of our colleagues in California who can irrigate more aggressively, get more predictable, you know, temperature accumulations. Oregon wines tend to come from vineyards that are farmed at slightly lower yields. That changes the economics and requires that we thrive at those higher price points. While the demand system is strong, we continue to see a tremendous amount of interest from around the world in the quality of Oregon wines. And as I said a second ago, it's one of the reasons why investment capital is coming here from France, from Washington State, and from California. People who study the business know that there's a real positive and solid and sustainable dynamic going on here. They want to be part of it, but it really, really hinges on our ability to continue to deliver quality. it's unlikely in the near term that we're going to be able to outsupply very many other growing regions. Mm-hmm. That's just the nature of our farming economics here. So for us, it's getting a disproportionate share of the dollars in the category rather than the cases in the category. And I'll come back to talk a little bit about that. I don't know if that answered your question.
It did. May I ask a follow-up? So that 2x growth in the supply side, do you think that's sustainable? Are we noticing, is it slowing? Is the growth slowing down? Do you think in 9 years from now we'll be at, for example, 50,000 acres planted?
I think we'll be higher than 50.
Really?
I think we're starting to probably approach, not the end, uh-huh. but we're probably at a midpoint where some of the most optimal grape-growing sites have been planted. That doesn't mean there isn't opportunities to improve the yield in some of these acres, but I try to pivot away from a conversation that's focused on case volume, uh-huh. because to our customers in the distributor and the restaurant and the wine shop business, what they look at is dollar volume. I want to go get more than my fair share of the category's dollar volume rather than just being obsessed by cases. So it's kind of a balanced approach a little bit. We know cases are important. You need to thrive at that level to be taken seriously, but we really focus on dollar growth.
Thank you.
Last thing I want to touch on here, and one of the reasons why right in the lower right-hand corner, right under the 2.4, I put the Southern Oregon logo, one of the things that has affected this business is the cutbacks at the USDA. They used to do a great annual statistical wrap-up of the industry, and about 3 years ago they ran into funding cuts, and that program became unaffordable for us. We were very fortunate to have the Southern Oregon University Research Center come forward and partner with us to conduct this absolutely critical annual study that produces the numbers that you're looking at now. That is the best way for us to document the growth of your industry and also to go lobby for more federal grant money. So if I were to say, is there an area where you might perhaps be helpful, it might be helping us sort out ways to continue to fund the research that allows us to report on our industry for you.
Yeah, thank you.
Some of this might be news from the past for some of you, but in 2011, and we'll be doing it again, 2011, the last economic impact study was created that has these kind of numbers. I'm going to come back in a few minutes and give you some very specific numbers about wine tourism, which is becoming a rapidly accelerating sort of a specialty area in the tourism community. I'll come back and talk about that. I also want to give you an overview of how our industry shakes out. I mentioned about 545 wineries spread across the state. What is deceptive is the scale and scope of them. And what you're seeing in this exhibit is the fact that about three-quarters of them are doing 5,000 cases or less. These are, and this is, it might seem like a little bit of a liability. It's really a positive. We talk to consumers, and one of the things that they play back to us about the Oregon wine reputation is these are tend to be family farms, small batch, artisan winemakers. One of the great commercials that our friends at Travel Oregon air outside our home market to get people to come here talks about how Oregon is one of those very rare places where you can visit a winery and drink wine with the winemaker. He can pour that for you. That's a pretty rare experience, and it happens because of this. So we're a balanced portfolio, but it is an industry largely comprised of small family farms. This might also be a little bit deceptive. When you think about the Oregon wine business, it might be known to many of you, but the kind of products we're producing here, they command premium prices. And what I've given you here is an exhibit that shows the overall wine category on the left side and the Oregon wine volume on the right side by price point. And you're probably trying to digest this because it really is an eye-opener how much of the category overall is skewing towards the more popular price points at the lower part of that left-hand bottle, but Oregon wine dramatically skewing into those tiers. What's also not shown here, because I just got this data, is we track Nielsen data when they show scanner reports for what the consumer is buying, because what I'm showing you here is the supply side of the equation. You look at the demand side of the equation, and the most rapidly growing segments are in those prices of $10 and up. But it's sometimes surprising how much wine is done below that price level. So Oregon really needs to thrive in those higher price points. Looking at the Nielsen data a little bit differently, show you what consumers are buying. we think we're a big business and we feel big and important, and then when you look at sometimes data like this, it's kind of humbling. But again, it's not focused as much on case volume, but it's focused on dollar volume. So we have a long way to go. But we're not really in a battle with anybody. We're just trying to continue to get more than our fair share of the dollar volume in the category. Right now, we're at about a 3 share. One of the things that is often asked is, why are these wines sometimes hard to find? Where can I go look for Oregon wines? And as you look across our business, one of the great opportunities is to continue to expand availability of our product. When you look at the Nielsen data, you'll find California. It's surprising that isn't 100%, but there are some areas where California wine is not in shelf sets, particularly import fine wine shops that are really focusing on imports. They kind of downplay domestic wines, but there are not many of those. But California has nearly universal penetration. Our colleagues up in Washington have also accelerated. And Oregon is at about a third of the stores in America that scan wine are selling Oregon wine. What's missing here, and it's important to distinguish, this doesn't really track restaurant sales. This is just showing about two-thirds of the business.
Does any of this have to do with the kinds of wines that wine grapes that we can grow in Oregon versus in the warmer areas? With this,
could you expand on that, Madam Chairman?
In other words, you know, they say that the wine market penetration, Oregon's got 33%. Is it because of the kinds of wines we make, as opposed to like Merlots and that kind of thing?
It's perhaps attributable to that, Madam Chairman. I think it's two other things happening. Number one is, I showed you before a little bit of an overview of our industry. There are many, many small wineries. Many of them are focused on the West Coast markets. This is a national number. Distributors across the country, they need to be coaxed into taking on some of these. So it's part of it is a distribution, and it will happen as we continue to mature. The second part of this is this particular metric is Nielsen scanner channels. The price points we compete in tend to be ones that really aren't grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
But we do very well in the fine wine shops, and we do very well in the on-premise, what's called the restaurant and hotel sector, places where you can ask a sommelier for a recommendation, or you can order something in a restaurant and ask the server, what will go well with this? Those kinds of hand-selling opportunities are great for Oregon.
Thank you.
Please.
Representative Fulton.
A similar question, but probably more pertinent to the slide with the bottles. Who's our competition in the price range that we seem to be, you know, from $11 up, compared to the average? Where's Washington at in that scale? Are they similar to Oregon, or are they, you know, lower?
Sure. What great question, Representative Holby. The Washington probably somewhat lower on average. Their tonnage is significantly higher, although they don't have many more wineries than we do. Significant more acreage, significant tonnage, and they get the benefit of growing the majority of their grapes on the sunnier, drier eastern part of their state, unlike Oregon, where we're a little bit skewed to the western side of the state. The impact of that is much higher yields. Much more favorable grape growing conditions, allowing them to farm an acre of land for wine grapes at a price that's a little more economical than we can do it here in Oregon, where the yields are lower. So when you ask who's our competition, it tends to be really a global environment for wines at that $11, $12, $13, $14 price point. Almost every region of the world has a certain tier of wines that compete in those price points. That's our competition. But as you'll see in just a second, we're really starting to, I won't say run away, but we're continuing to differentiate primarily on the strength of our primary grape, Pinot Noir, and I'll come to that in just a sec. It's a good question, though. I want to share just a little bit, real quick, some consumer insights. One of our partners in market research is Linfield College, and they have a couple of faculty members who are experts on assessing and measuring reputations of corporations, brands. We invited them, and they were really eager to partner with us on assessing the reputation of our wine region. And they went out and talked to about 900 consumers, and let me tell you what we're known for. When you talk to about 900 consumers who buy in the price points where where we have to thrive. They play back messages about Oregon that are linked to handcrafted artisan nature of our winemaking. Again, small family farms, and you can see the other points there. But the kind of things that really are kind of somewhat romantic about the wine business. One of the kiss of death in wine business is to be a corporate or a factory winemaking operation. We are so fortunate that we have no association with that at all, for the obvious reasons. We went a little bit further, and these are numbers that, again, reflect a consumer sample of a little over 900. But you can see in the upper left there, about 867 of those people agree Oregon is making high-quality wines. In fact, that's just a slightly higher notch than the way those people rank California. You can see the handcrafted symbols, the scores, I'm sorry. You can also see the fourth point on here, a travel destination for wine tourism. It's popular. We're getting good scores. You can see California's been at it a little bit longer than us, and I'm going to come back and talk just a little bit about some things we do to address that. But the last point that popped up is kind of related to your question, Madam Chairman, about this availability question. When we ask people, is it easy to find? Not yet. Mm-hmm. And candidly, that probably won't change really dramatically very quickly, but in the places where our price points sell most effectively, we're continuing to hammer home at distribution. A little bit of further reinforcement, asking that same group of consumers, about 900 people, what are they thinking about when they're asked to pay just a little bit more? Because that's the dynamic, is where's our premium? And as you can see in the left-hand two bars, it's about our sense of place. There's kind of three rules of fine wine marketing. You either emphasize your product, you emphasize your place, or you emphasize your people. There's no place like Oregon for being able to vector in all three of those dimensions. But place is absolutely critical. Why? It's one of the reasons why in my job, our goal is to focus on brand Oregon. And we partner up with our regional associations across the state, and they talk about their specific area. But it's my job to focus on brand Oregon. Let me give you a little bit of report card on that. You may or may not be familiar with magazines that talk about the wine business. This one is the top of the heap. The Wine Spectator reaches almost three people every couple of weeks. And if you're like me when I first came into the wine business, you're really quick to say, you know, boy, I don't know a lot about the wine business, but I know some people who do. Those people who do read this. And the people who sell wine at the higher price points, they read this so they know what to put on their shelves and their wine lists. But you can see by this cover story, it's the focus at the wine board is brand Oregon, and that's what's replayed on this cover. And of course, you can see the primary variety that we're best known for. Give you a chance to digest this comment. This is the kind of feedback that certainly gets the attention of fine wine retailers, restaurateurs, even the consumer. And it's probably been happening for a while at a low level. We're now getting this kind of acclaim so consistently that it's impossible now to ignore. Let me go a little bit further on that point. It was a great question just a second ago. Representative Holby asked about Washington and California and who do we compete with. The Wine Spectator rates many wines on a 100-point scale, and one of your first things you might ask, well, why aren't we getting 100 points? Nobody gets 100 points. Your Chateau Latour, you might get 100 points every 3 or 4 years. But in the wine trade, a score of 90-plus is a really significant marker of quality. Anybody above 90 is going to get special attention. Those wines will become allocated and very difficult to get. When you look at the number of wines from Oregon that are achieving that marker, you can see it's 46%. You can also see the price the consumer is asked to pay for that level of quality for Oregon and how it compares to the world. Again, another reinforcement that Oregon has just flat out never made the quality of wine that it's making right now. Never made it as consistently as it's making it now. It's an absolutely sensational time to be doing what we're doing.
Madam Chair.
Please.
I could real quick. Just a quick question as we're going through some of this. Because obviously we have good margins in our wine. I'm seeing that. We also have some of the big California wineries that are looking at buying a lot of our small wineries up here. Is that going to put us into that manufacturing process when you have the Kendall Jacksons of the world and groups like that coming up here and buying up our wineries? What's that going to do to branding Oregon and things like that? If you could.
Sure, it's a very good question. And I hear it as I travel around the state and, in fact, talk to some of my colleagues from around the world. I think there are two things that, while we're not complacent about the comment that you make or we're not dismissing it, I think there are two things happening that are worth noting. Number one, the economics of our farming here on grape farming are probably not likely to change in the near term. That tends to push our prices up just a little bit. But more importantly, some of the people who are coming here with investment capital, they're not necessarily buying brands. They're buying assets to build brands. Jackson Family Winery is a great example. They bought acreage. They're going to build a winery. They are doing it in a very Oregon way. They're going to plant the vineyard. They're going to bring it along slowly and carefully because they know that the quality they have to hit for the margin to make sense, it has to be sort of, you have to farm for the kind of level of quality that returns the money that you have to make back. So there will be some brand acquisitions, but most of the people who are bringing capital here are wanting to buy assets and build brands because they recognize Oregon as something they desperately need in their portfolio. I'm not yet seeing too many signs that we're going to become a factory environment, again, because of the realities of the farming costs. It tends to push you into price tiers where quality is absolutely critical. I don't know if maybe that answers the question, but maybe there's more.
It's a good answer. It just kind of gives me an idea because we're seeing a lot of that take place, and I can see some of the smaller wineries. And one of the things that makes France unique is everything specific to regions and the way they do things. And every, even different countries, Argentina, known for Malbecs.
That's right. Know. Very good point.
And Oregon is known for Pinot Noir, and that's basically, if you're kind of what we're developing and everything, you want a Pinot, you buy it from Oregon. So that's why I'm kind of looking at some of these other guys coming in. Are we going to be specifying that? Do we want to tailor to the smaller wineries like we have now? What's going to happen when you get the large capital dollars coming in from these large wineries out of California and other countries, and they start engulfing five or six wineries and buying them up? Are they going to probably keep them out as a different brand for each one, which would make sense to me if they did it, and I think it makes more sense to their bottom line, but that's a business decision
I think
they have to make, and you have more insight into what they're looking at doing than I would.
I think you're right. That's a really great observation. The portfolio approach to having multiple brands in your portfolio has been proven time and time again as a really viable and intelligent wine strategy. In fact, many wineries adopt what you might what they call a string of pearls approach. Each individual winery from each specific region, like Mendoza in Argentina, since you bring it up, or New Zealand, Sauvignon Blanc, each winery from a specific region is a pearl on that string, and the string that holds it together is the corporate entity, but that's hidden from the consumer and most wine buyers. But I think we're definitely in an era where having a portfolio approach to selling wine is critical. The people who are making wine lists and setting their shelves in the fine wine shops, they need to have an Italian and a Spanish section and a German section, and we're now to the point where now you absolutely have to have an Oregon section. It used to be a curiosity, maybe. Now it is something you have to have. People are seeing the covers, like I showed you, of the Wine Spectator, and they're bringing it in, and they want that wine that got the 94 score. So it's happening. But I'd say overall, I'd say we're going to see continued careful investment from well-capitalized companies that recognize that Oregon is a brand they need to have, and they'll respect the economics. And if they don't, it will be difficult for them here.
Thank you.
How are you on time?
Oh, we're fine. Maybe wrap it up like 10 after.
Sure, yeah. We'll do it. I'll just press forward. This is just another example of the kind of write-ups that we continue to get. And this particular one is important. It's by a writer named Robert Parker, who has a tremendous influence with the wine insiders and the wine trade. Just another example of the kind of acclaim that we're getting. Go right ahead. The other interesting observation comes from the online community. Snooth.com is something that didn't even exist a few years ago. Now it is the number one online wine community in the world. And when they designate a region of the year, it is a big deal. And it just happened for Oregon a couple of weeks ago. This is something that will continue to generate interest for us all the way through 14. Our reputation not only includes wineries, but it also includes growers. Right near Philomath, PK and Di Crisp run the Temperance Hill vineyard owned by the Koo family, and there's one and only one grower.
Strange name for somebody to grow wine grapes.
Yeah.
Ironic.
It does go back a ways, but it's
too pricey to drink a lot.
I like that.
What's interesting about this is it's from Wine and Spirits magazine, which you can see in the upper right-hand corner there. They pick one and only one grower from all around the world to designate as grower of the year. When this happens for Oregon, it's just another validation, not only of the winemaking, but of the farming that contributes to the winemaking. I mentioned a little bit, and as I start to wrap up, I just want to talk and acknowledge the really extraordinary effort and the open arms that have been extended to us in the wine community from our friends at the Oregon Tourism Commission, Travel Oregon. In fact, you might be aware that one of our winery owners is on the Board of Commissioners with with Travel Oregon, and they have opened some doors for us that have just been sensational. It's a terrific partnership. Let me give you some dashboard numbers on how tourism plays out here. Again, that $158 million in tourism economic impact is from our study just a couple years ago. We think that's a little higher than that now. But we're now to the point where 1 million of Oregon's visitors every year are visiting a winery, and they're acknowledging it as an important motivator when they plan their trip. And my counterpart at the Tourism Bureau, Todd Davidson, makes a great point about how the behavior continues when they go home. 60% of people who come here go home and talk about and buy Oregon products. And right at the top of the heap is fine wine. Right near us is our colleagues in the craft beer business at 26%. And we can, of course, make this available in hard copy if this would help you, because I know you probably go back to your districts and get questions about the wine business. But certainly one of the key things, again, wine tourism is getting people out into wine country, whether it's, you know, Southern Oregon or Milton Free Water area, right around Bend. There's so many wineries, again, 545. Getting them out is a really unique selling point. That's the way that our wineries can sign people up for their wine club. And when someone joins a wine club and goes home to Chicago, they've now got wines to share with their friends and family. But getting people into wineries is the number one way for us to evangelize about it and to continue to bring people into the tent. Another one of these great only,
you know, it's interesting,
in,
if you go back with the tourism, I volunteer at Albertina's restaurant as a cook, and we have these fundraiser luncheons, and we have a series now on wine, and it's like we will pair wines with Greek food, we will pair wines with Basque food, with Italian, and it's all Oregon wines that we go through and pair the food with,
right.
And they're sold out every month when we do this.
That's sensational news. Uh-huh. It's, we've talked a lot about Pinot Noir because it is sort of the first thing that many people think of, but our Chardonnay production is increasing, Pinot Gris, some other different varieties, Syrah are starting to grow, but boy, Pinot Noir is a great way to start the conversation, especially when we get the kind of write-ups from critics that I've shown you today. But as people get more and more into Oregon wine, they are often expressing an interest for Chardonnay or Pinot Gris or Syrah, and it becomes a much more rich palette of food pairings and different doors to the same room rather than just Pinot Noir, which is still great, but we're now diversifying.
When you can pair with Basque, when you can, you know, pair it up with Basque and Spanish food, that shows we do have diversity.
Right.
So,
yeah. That's right. let me press on here.
Madam Chair, I just one quick comment. You know, I made the mistake several sessions ago of talking about Pinot Noir and Pinot Noir, Pinot Noir. I recently did my own survey in California and went to several wineries, and you know, the winemakers down there recognize Oregon mostly for its Pinot Gris. They think that their Oregon's Pinot Gris is tops.
So it's important research, Representative Holden.
Yes. Thank you.
I just thought I'd add.
State funded trip, right?
You know, I don't want,
is there anything else you'd like to put on the record?
A Pinot Noir snob, like I used to be.
Perhaps we could get a legislative study group on that.
Yes. Pinot Gris
is. Pinot Gris is far away the number one white wine in the state, and it's the number two wine overall. What it does for us is might not be visible on the surface, because it's a very good point you make, Representative Holby. When you go into a large wine shop, they are often looking for a white and a red that they can build into an end cap display, because you just sometimes have people who don't like reds. Pinot Gris is that answer for us, and you have to have that answer now to merchandise in the marketplace. You've simply got to have a white and a red, and it's a really nice pairing. We bookend that really well.
Great point.
Thank you for your research.
Yeah, that's right. I want to also touch on another program that came about from our partnership with Travel Oregon. They do a great job focusing on Oregon food and craft beverages, and they put on a big bounty program that culminates in the Feast event every September. As part of that, their partner, Alaska Airlines, was willing to hear us out on an amendment to a proposal, a program that they run in some smaller cities. They've got this program called Wine Flies Free, and they've historically wanted to do it only in some of their smaller, underserved markets, like Santa Rosa, California, or Walla Walla, Washington. The idea is, if you visit one of those wine tourism areas, they will waive the customer's fee that they charge most people when they check a case of wine to go home. So that fee's waived, so the consumer can buy the wine, take it home without paying that check fee. Well, they had not really thought fully exploited the opportunity to do a statewide program. They were open to our suggestion that in all four Oregon cities, from Medford to Redmond, Oregon, to Eugene and Portland, that they do a statewide program for the first time that began in September and just, in fact, wraps up today, where anybody visiting an Oregon winery can, and flying home on Alaska, wherever they live, can check that case of Oregon wine home for free with the baggage fee waived. So that's a huge benefit to us, continues to drive tourism and anchors our relationship not only with Travel Oregon but with this partner, which we hope to continue that.
We decided we want to go to summer camp with Oregon Pinot Camp.
Yeah, this is one of the slides that provokes that reaction that, you know, when you tell your friends and family and coworkers what you're doing, they can't really believe you get paid to do this. People from around the world pay their own way to come here for many of the events that I've listed here. And I listed here just to give you a sense of the broader ecosystem that is spawned by the wine and grape growing businesses. All these events help fill hotel rooms. They help fill restaurants. They help, they help us build evangelists that will go home and talk about Oregon and about Oregon wine, about Oregon craft beers, about Oregon food. We're working on a really good way to kind of document and kind of metric this, but it has spawned an ecosystem that is absolutely envied by just about everybody. In fact, I was thinking on the way in today, thinking about sitting in this chair, talking with you here today, and I'm thinking about my colleagues who'd probably do the same thing in state capitals all around the country, and they are just dying to get what we have right here. A business that thrives, that generates tourism and generates, you know, a really positive reputation for the state. I'm sure you probably get many questions as I do, because it's an obvious one. How does Oregon compare to our friends up in the Northwest in Washington? You can see they don't have that many more wineries than us. They do have a larger composition of large wineries, mm-hmm. not just where I work, but they have St. Michel, but they have a larger group of wineries that are well in excess of 5,000 cases. You can see their harvest tonnage is significant. Again, they can grow the majority of their crop on the warmer eastern side of the state where irrigation and temperature accumulation is greater. You can see our case volumes are significantly different.
Can I ask you about that on
sure.
the Oregon side? Is it just that the eastern part of Oregon is not as conducive to that, or there just has not been a push to grow grapes in eastern Oregon?
Because
there's a lot of similarities between eastern Oregon and eastern Washington.
You're right. It's accelerating dramatically.
The Gorge, I think it's accelerating.
In the Gorge, in the Hood River, certainly, in mm-hmm. the Dalles, in the Milne Freewater area. We're seeing kind of a funny thing happen. The Walla Walla area is known as obviously a Washington destination, but the technical definition of the viticultural area for Walla Walla actually spans part of Oregon, where the majority of the Walla Walla area's grapes are grown. The wines are often made right across the state line in wineries, but one of the best-kept secrets in the business is that the backbone of those great Walla Walla wines is Oregon fruit. And we're going to start telling that story because we've got growers that are accelerating their vineyard plantings. But I think over the years it has been just a slightly slower migration towards wine grapes compared to the other crops that are farmed more more easily there. But that is changing, and Walla Walla is a great epicenter. And in fact, I don't want to disparage our colleagues up in Washington. They are terrific partners. In fact, whenever we go outside the country and do an international event, as we do a couple times a year, we partner together to go for a joint federal grant, and we go together because we stand together because many of our grape growing, our grape varieties are not in competition at all. They're not real strong in Pinot Gris, Chardonnay, and Pinot Noir. They're stronger in Merlot and other grapes like that. So it's a really, compatible portfolio rather than a competitive one.
If I could, real quick,
please.
When you get east of the Cascades, you have a little harsher climate. So sometimes in September, we can hit freezing temperatures and things like that. Yeah. So I'm just wondering, have they ran into issues with that in Washington when they're on the other side? Is it a big issue? Because I know that's something that's a benefit that we have on the west side of the state is right now we're just hitting our freezing temperatures.
That's a great observation. Yes, on the western side of the state we don't have to intervene as dramatically with frost protection, but certainly on the eastern side of the state where it wasn't that many years ago they got down to 12 and you can have hard kill of a crop. It's one of the reasons why the balance shifts just a bit towards those winter hardy varieties in the eastern parts of both states like Riesling. It's a concern. So you wind up with more aggressive frost protection, higher expense for the farmer. You wind up changing your varietal mix just a little bit to tolerate those temperatures, and you learn how to prune more carefully, and you learn to adapt. But certainly the temperatures are something to be taken very seriously. They can limit yield.
Over here, it's just rain and getting the crop in real fast.
Getting it right is an issue. Last point I'll make about Washington. They are terrific partners. They have made a significant investment in their business. There was private money raised, and the state legislature offered up $5 million to fund what's on the screen now, this Wine Science Center that'll be housed at Washington State University's Tri-Cities campus. And we're somewhat fortunate that the director of this holds a master's from Oregon State, so we're friendly with Dr. Hennick Kling, who's been a very good partner and has seized the need again to do research that benefits both the winter hardy varieties that thrive in eastern Washington and the Burgundian varieties that thrive on the western part of Oregon. So that's a really good partnership. In fact, they'll take their first students this fall. Last couple points I'll make is just to give you a flavor, because I'm often asked where where might our industry benefit from some help or some assistance or some focus? Certainly continued technical research, because wine quality is everything. That is the bedrock value that will propel this industry, as it already has.
Is that being done at Oregon State?
A lot of it's done at Oregon State. There is also some done with their extension service around the state. But certainly the fermentation sciences money that was awarded last year was a terrific start. We would love to give you all the information that you need from us to continue that, because it not only brings the wine community together with the craft beer and the cheese and the bread business, but it provides insight into a community that generates not only $3 billion in economic impact like wine, but $7 billion when you aggregate all those fermentation products together.
If I may, he's being polite. We funded the fermentation sciences program about half of what it needed. There's room for improvement there. That would be about another $600,000-$700,000 per biennium that would be well spent.
Thank you for that, because we would totally agree. In fact, the figure you just referred to, as I said a second ago, compares to about a $5 million number that Washington put into that Wine Science Center. And while that would be ambitious, I think we're eager to have the full assortment of fermentation sciences categories supported to the degree that they deserve it. Because in all those categories, beer and cheese and wine and even bread to some degree, those are premium branded products that wind up saying something about Oregon to people far beyond our borders, and they have a multiplier effect that's just really sensational. I'll say two other quick things, and then I'll move on to this slide. We will have our annual membership of the Oregon Wine Growers Association meeting back here in Salem on January 15th, and we'll remind you right before that, but we'd absolutely love to have you come. We'll be at the Salem Convention Center. Love to have you there and give you a chance to talk directly with some of our growers. And beyond that, our other showcase event takes place in Portland. It's our Oregon Wine Symposium. And we bring about 1,500 people in from all over the world who are interested to learn how we do what we do here. Not only the winemaking, but how we do the branding and the marketing. And that's a terrific opportunity, again, for you to get a little more exposure into the wine community. Looking ahead, the last thing I'll mention here, a couple points where our focus lies. You've heard me talk about research supporting quality. That's a bedrock element. We've talked a little bit about some of the issues that present themselves when we try to go for expanded availability. We're working with a local company in Portland now that's developing a digital presentation that will tell people a little bit about Oregon, the grapes we grow here, some of the acclaim we get from writers. That's, we're working with a small company in Portland, and if you're looking for ways to help the business in a way that that would really accelerate this issue of availability, that's one area that funding continues to be really well used for. It supports a local development company that's doing a digital presentation for us, and creates local jobs on their side, supports local jobs here on our side. The third point is really critical. Penetrate those market channels, primarily the fine wine shops, the better, more higher-end Epicurean grocery stores, the restaurants, those places where the wines at the price point that we need to thrive at, where those wines sell. And there's a thriving segment of the market, as I mentioned, as baby boomers age into those key wine-producing years and higher-income years, they're going to have more disposable income. We're trying to get more than our fair share of it, you know. And the last point is wine tourism. We continue to look for opportunities to drive more of that, and we, again, can't thank our friends at Travel Oregon and certainly people in this room enough for that. So maybe there's other questions you have, but it's an absolutely treasure of a business that says so many good things about Oregon. We're glad to have a chance to share some of it with you.
Okay, thank you. Representative
Grant. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for being here.
Sure.
Not often from Southern Oregon do we get to talk about positive things happening, but this is one of them. The wine industry is doing very well in Douglas County and in Southern Oregon. As you're aware, and the committee may not be aware, we have at our community college the Southern Oregon Wine Institute, which is a course that... First, it's a beautiful facility they built, but they're having courses in all sorts of the winemaking skills that are needed, along with a full-service lab, keep that technical quality that was discussed in the presentation up for our area. And it's being promoted in our area that this final phase of a large winery that's going in, or a large vineyard, will be the largest in the state when finished. So things are really amazingly happening around Douglas County and Southern Oregon around the wine industry. And thank you for your work, and I want to thank the rest of the legislators for their support for the wine industry, because it is one of those very few things that's going very well for us in Southern Oregon. So thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments?
In fact, the last point I was going to just build on that, Representative Freeman, is I mentioned these designated viticulture areas around the state, and the newest and one of the most highly esteemed is Elkton. It's a very, very small area relative to some of the larger ones, but absolutely sensational wine quality coming out of Elkton. Another nice bridge to what you just said, I'm glad you brought up the Southern Oregon Wine Institute. It's a terrific example right there on the campus of Umpqua Community College of how we talk a lot about sustainability, and we think about that in terms of farming, but in terms of a sustainable labor force, the students coming out of that Southern Oregon Wine Institute program, they've had exposure in a working winery right on campus. They come out job ready, and that is a huge economic benefit and an accelerator for Douglas County, because those kids feed right into a thriving industry. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for your time.
I when I look at it, and I see that, for example, that Washington County, if you've got some of the vineyards up in Helvetia, which, so that was always cow country, dairy country. Well, you couldn't have cows up there. It was too slopey, but it was perfect for growing grapes. So it's just a
there's
nice
a lot of counterintuitive things about the wine business. One is that you wouldn't want to plant on sloped land, but, boy, the grapes really like to be tilted up towards the sun.
Oh, yes, they do.
You know,
But thank you so much. Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much for the update, because it is part of the Oregon economy that is huge, and we appreciate what you do.
Thank you
very much.
All right.
Okay, the last presentation we have is an overview of the specific functions of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And so, Gerhard Taubel, and Jennifer Goodmanson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Anna Braun. I'm the legislative director for Boley. I just want to make sure Jennifer goes first, because she has to go to another committee after this one. So she's going to give an overview.
Please go ahead.
This guy gave $800,000 to start the campaign to build that building.
That's good.
Good.
Oh, you got it. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jennifer Germanson. I manage the Bureau of Labor and Industries Technical Assistance for Employers program, and thank you for the opportunity to talk briefly about the services Boley provides to Oregon business, Oregon employers. I just want to talk briefly about the Bureau of Labor and Industries, so you can see where Boley Technical Assistance fits into the services we provide. Boley is a fairly small state agency with less than 100 employees. We have the Apprenticeship and Training Division. We have the Civil Rights Division. And, of course, we have the Wage and Hour Division that Gerhard will be talking about shortly. And then we also have the educational component of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, which is technical assistance for employers. The reason we have a red line on there is that is the firewall. Technical assistance is a safe harbor for employers. We don't run to our friends in civil rights or the wage and hour division and tell them about an employer who's contacted us about an issue they're having with an employee, or perhaps they're not paying minimum wage, they're not paying overtime. There are issues there. We are the safe harbor for these employers, and there is a firewall between technical assistance and the enforcement arm of the agency. We don't have access to current cases. We're not able to discuss anything that's going on with the current claim against an employer. Technical assistance is actually not very good at slides, I can tell, because this should be two bullets. We are a relatively small group. There are 6 employees and technical assistance for employers, and we are primarily a self-supporting unit. 2 biennia ago, we got some tax dollars to help support the administrative functions, including our employer phone assistance line. But the rest of the unit is primarily self-supporting, and I'll talk about how we get those funds.
If you hit your space bar, the other bullets will probably come up because we have them here.
Okay. Well, I was going to go one by one, but I can do this too. Thank you. We have the employer assistance phone line. This is a phone service that is free to Oregon employers. They can contact technical assistance for employers through our phone line or through an email service where we can answer questions about wage and hour, about civil rights laws, about other employment-related issues. And I will tell you that we have a number of referrals to other agencies because they will call us about I-9 forms, for example. And right now we're getting a lot of phone calls about Portland sick leave. In the past, employers needed to leave a message, and we got back to them within 24 hours. Several weeks ago, we worked on our phone system, and now employers call, and in most cases, they're going to get a live body. Mm. It will ring through to all of the technical assistants, the 6 of us, to our numbers, and generally they're going to be able to get a live body. And it's been interesting recently because we have a lot of hang-ups. People call and I think they're not prepared for the fact they're going to get a live person on the phone. This is a huge benefit to employers because if you're dealing with a payroll issue or you're dealing with a difficult employee situation, you want to have somebody to talk to right away. This is going to be a huge benefit, I think, to employers. And unfortunately, I think employees have now found out they can call technical assistance and they're going to get a live body. So we have a lot of referrals to wage and hour and to civil rights. In the last year, we answered around 18,000 inquiries from employers, and 98% of those were responded to within 24 hours. We also have employer advice columns. We write hopefully weekly or at least monthly advice columns on current topics of interest. Right now we're starting to write columns about holiday pay and religion in the workplace because these holidays are starting to come up. We're starting to get a lot of calls from employers about that. Those are sent out to around 37 different media outlets. We also send them to chambers. We work very closely with the Oregon Employer Council through the Oregon Employment Department. So these columns go out to a large number of Oregon businesses, and they also appear on our website. The BOLI website is a wealth of information for employers. We have around 110 frequently asked questions and fact sheets. We work to keep those updated. So many times employers and employees can take a look at those fact sheets and we'll get an answer to their question right away. They're written in very easy to understand language. We don't put legalese into this. And those are frequently updated, and we're adding right now because there's a couple of new laws that are going to be effective January of 2014. So these are the services that are provided to Oregon employers. There's no charge for these services. So let's talk a little bit about the services that employers are going to have a fee for. BOLI Technical Assistance conducts seminars all throughout the state on a variety of employment law topics, wage and hour laws, family leave laws, effective supervisory practices. And we've also started, the latter part of 2012, we started a 6-month new supervisor series. This is a series that new supervisors, employers can sign their supervisors up for. It's 3 hours once a month for 6 months. And so at the end of this, they've got 18 hours of training, and they've been able to build upon the skills through each month. This has proven to be very, very popular. We started out with limiting that to 35 attendees. And for our last series, the July through December series, we had 52 people sign up, and we finally had to cut it off because it was too large of a group. We are looking to expand that to a series in Salem specifically geared towards state agencies. Mm-hmm. We also conduct on-site trainings, and these are customized on-site trainings for employers, for business organizations, for different groups. Many employers will contact us to provide workplace harassment training for their entire workforce, and it's a cost-effective way to do this. They can fit 200 people into a room. We can train all of their employees, and they all get the same information. It's great prevention for these employers. Sometimes employers have cases that are being settled, and part of the agreement is that technical assistance has to come out and conduct training for their employees, managers, and supervisors. And many employers will have, or organizations will contract with us to come out and provide training to a group of employers in their area. We work very closely with the Oregon Employer Council, and this is the nonprofit organization attached to the Oregon Employment Department field offices. In the past, we found that if we went to Klamath Falls or to Ontario, for example, it was difficult to get enough employers in the room that wanted to pay the fees to be gone from work for an entire day and to warrant, to really cover our costs to go out and conduct these trainings in those areas. Our partnership with the Oregon Employer Council has been so beneficial because we work with those councils. They're able to get bodies in the seats. We generally have three-hour seminars. And for smaller businesses, it may be difficult to have your manager or supervisor away for an entire workday. In some cases, it's a business owner with maybe one employee. Having these three-hour seminars in those areas at a greatly reduced cost has really impacted what we're able to do throughout the state. And the last year we did, we conducted 138 seminars, and 65 of the seminars were outside of the Portland-Salem Eugene area. We were in Ontario, we were in Baker City, we did a seminar in Klamath Falls and had 90 employers. I think there were 90 employers in Klamath Falls. So we are out there, we are all over the state providing these services. And then the other service we provide to employers is publications and posters. At this point, we publish 8 employer handbooks, wage and hour laws, family leave laws, developing an employee handbook, for example. We update these every 2 years or after a legislative session where there's been significant changes to the laws that are reflected in those books. In 2014, we've got it ready right now. We'll have it available by December 4th. For our annual employment law conference, we developed the 2014 Family Leave Laws Handbook. And this covers the Oregon Family Leave Act, the Federal Family and Medical Leave, and the other leaves that employers who might not be affected by the Oregon Family Leave Act because they're too small still must comply with. So it's a greatly expanded version to the last version we did. We're happy to have that available. In 2014, we'll be revising our wage and hour handbook as well as our civil rights laws handbook because there are significant changes from 2012 when these were last done. We also prepare composite posters. There are a number of poster requirements under federal and state law that employers are required to post. We have links to all of those posters available on our website, free for download. And then we also prepare composite posters so employers can purchase those for $10, which is significantly less than the $75 to $125 some of the large poster companies will charge. These are just some stats from our last program year. Trained around almost 4,000 employers throughout Oregon, around 18,000 phone calls and email inquiries were responded to, 55 public seminars, 78 on-site seminars, and again, 65 of those were outside Portland, Salem, Eugene areas. So we're getting to all parts of the state. This is just a slideshow, slide showing our current available publications. These are available for employers. The most expensive book is $40. The least expensive book is our Child Labor Laws Handbook, which is $15. Not a huge cost, and for employers who attend our seminars, they get a reduced price for those as well.
Are those available online as well?
Madam Chair, Representative Kennemere, they are not available online at this point because this is, our publications are the primary source of funding for technical assistance for employers. We've had many requests to have them online. We are looking at updating our technology, so we might be able to have some type of a subscription service for those as well. I would like to add that many employers have called and asked about having them online, and why does the state agency charge for these publications? And so we do have to explain this funds the program. If we don't sell the handbooks and the posters and conduct seminars for a fee, at some point our program will go away unless we get fully funded.
Okay.
Just some highlights for 2012-2013. We developed six brand new seminars. We conduct one very popular seminar called The Life of a Workers' Compensation Claim. We have someone from Workers' Compensation. We have an attorney who works with us, and we have someone from Workers' Comp Preferred Worker Program. And so we're able to talk about the full gamut of a workers' compensation claim, how it might affect family leave laws, attendance policies, and answer all of those specific questions employers have about reinstatement or reemployment rights when one of their workers has been injured. That's developed new for 2012-2013. Extremely popular seminar, very well attended. I talked about our six-month new supervisor series. Again, I think very, very valuable. I think many employees are moved into supervisory positions, don't understand management, don't understand employment law, and many employers find themselves walking into some trouble with other parts of the agency because a supervisor doesn't understand the law. This is prevention. We updated seven of our handbooks in 2012, and this year we're starting a new round of this. Again, more than 65 of our seminars took place outside of the metro areas in very remote areas of the state. We did one in Burns. And we've really worked on our partnerships with the Oregon Employment Department. We're working with the Small Business Development Centers. I did some training in Fossil earlier this year. And we're also trying to outreach to more of the chambers and trying to get more information out to Oregon employers about what Boley Technical Assistance does, the resources that we have for these employers. We're also working with the Secretary of State's Corporation Division on having some of our information, our contact information, information about some of our services sent out with their annual renewal certificate. And this relatively small map just shows the areas that the areas that we've trained in the last program year. So you can see we're all over the state. We're continuing to work to get to all parts of the state, and it looks like for 2014 we're going to surpass what we've done in the last year. So, okay. May I answer any questions?
Any questions? Because I know you do have another hearing to go to. Okay. Thank you. Very very good information. We appreciate
thank you
very,
it very
much.
Much.
Okay. I hope I didn't butcher your name. Mr. Towell?
I'll correct you in a minute.
Thank you very much.
Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gerhard Teubel. I'm with the Wage and Hour Division.
Close.
That's all I can ask for with my name. I know it's a very difficult one. I'm the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm very happy to be here this morning and for the invitation to discuss with you the activities of the Wage and Hour Division, and more specifically to talk a little bit about our wage collection program, which I understand may be of some interest to some members of the committee. What you see here is the Portland State Office Building, which is the main office of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and it's where the Wage and Hour Division has its primary presence, although we do have some field offices, one here in Salem, which deals specifically with farm labor kind of issues, but we also have a civil rights presence there and some general wage and hour investigators. We also have a field office in the Eugene office. In total, the Wage and Hour Division has about 30 employees. Seven of those are investigators who do investigate wage and hour claims and complaints. In addition, we have five investigators who focus solely on prevailing wage investigations. When I talk about the division's programs, I often like to give a little bit of context so that people understand where the division fits into say, the economy generally, or what the bigger picture is as far as the wage and hour division's role in the workplace. The latest Census Bureau statistics show that there are about 110,000 employers in Oregon employing about 1.5 million workers. So that's a significant portion of Oregonians who, in one way or another, their lives are touched by the regulations that the Wage and Hour Division administers. They are employees. You know, they depend on their paychecks for their livelihoods, to pay their rent, to, you know, provide for themselves and their families. And I think this places a great responsibility on the Wage and Hour Division to make sure that generally there's compliance in the state with the wage and hour regulations. In addition, a large number of the employers in Oregon are in such industries as the retail trade, for example, or food and lodging. These also happen to be two industries where you find many employees who earn a low wage, and it also, and it probably doesn't surprise anybody, it's the industries where we at the Wage and Hour Division receive a lot of wage claims. And I say this just to illustrate that the types of claims that the division tends to investigate and look at are claims that are filed by employees who earn a relatively low wage, either at the minimum wage or perhaps slightly above the minimum wage. And I'll talk more about that when I talk about the wage collection program. But the division is involved in several different aspects of wage and hour law. Like I mentioned, we investigate the payment of wages, which includes minimum wage and overtime. We investigate complaints about working conditions, primarily rest and meal periods, and whether these are being provided appropriately in a workplace. We're involved with the protection of children in the workplace in two ways. One, we license employers who wish to employ minors, and through this licensing program, we're able to educate employers about, you know, what's required when one is employing minors, what hours are minors available to work, what kinds of work can they perform, and sometimes we can steer employers away from hiring minors in types of work that are not really appropriate for them at their age. We also investigate complaints that are filed regarding violations of the child labor laws. We are very much involved in prevailing wage rates and public works projects. We're the main enforcement body for that, for state prevailing wage rate projects. So our prevailing wage rate unit, the team, investigates complaints that we receive when it appears that the prevailing wage is not being paid on public works projects. And finally, the division licenses farm and forest labor contractors, and we also regulate the regulations around the licensing and the requirements of farm and forest labor contractors. So, you know, we have a lot of interaction with both employees and employers in the state through these various programs that go, you know, cut across a number of different industries.
Madam Chair, a quick question. I know last session we passed House Bill 2977, which also licenses construction labor contractors. Tell me the status of implementing that.
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Holy. If you remember, that doesn't take effect until July 2015, so we haven't written the rules for that yet. We were focusing this year on writing the rules for the other legislation that passed this last session, but that will be coming up in the next year, and we will begin looking at how we're going to implement that legislation.
So do you have a projection of that rulemaking process?
Timeline,
I guess.
Oh, sure. Madam Chair, Representative Holby, while I don't have a formal timeline yet, I anticipate that is going to happen probably around mid-year, the next year of 2014.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So I just gave you a brief description of the division's programs, what that translates into in terms of numbers are is reflected here in the quick facts. And these represent an average over the last 5 or 6 years of the division's activities. We collect approximately $1.75 million per year for employees in Oregon. We do that through the wage claims that we receive. That's approximately 2,100 wage claims per year, as well as the 150 or so prevailing wage rate investigations that we conduct each year. In addition to that, you may be aware that the state of Oregon is about the only state in the country that has a wage security fund program. That's a program which the division administers, and it pays out unpaid final wages to workers when a business has failed and is unable to pay the final wages and doesn't have the assets to pay the wages. So Oregon employees are able to file a claim with the Bureau. We investigate the claim. If it seems that the business is out of business, does not have the assets to pay, and the wages are eligible for payment from the fund, we can pay out to $4,000 to those employees. And over the last few years, on average, we've paid nearly $750,000 from that fund. The fund itself comes from a small diversion of unemployment taxes that are collected by the Employment Department. Other activities, we receive about 1,300 non-wage and hour complaints. That means complaints around working conditions predominantly, or it may be complaints about payday, late paydays, those sorts of things. We also issue about 4,100 employment certificates per year for employers who wish to employ minors. And a statistic not reflected here, but complements something that Jennifer talked about earlier, where they're getting thousands of calls from employers each year that they field. We field in the Wage and Hour Division thousands and thousands of calls from employees who are just questioning, what do the wage and hour laws say about a certain kind of situation, and we try to provide them some guidance around those issues.
The employers that employ minors, I mean, what are the examples? These restaurants, farm work, that kind of thing? What sort of jobs?
Yeah, Madam Chair, it's across the board. A lot of it is, sometimes it's restaurants, not so much in the farm labor industry, I think we find service industries of various kinds. Sometimes construction, but that's very limited to what a minor can do in that industry.
Mostly restaurant services.
Yeah, basically retail and restaurants and those kinds of industries.
Can you expand
yes.
a little bit on the...
Go, please.
Can you expand a little bit on the restrictions for minors and really how that has changed over the last 10 or 15 years?
Those of us that pick strawberries for
yeah.
years.
I think it's pretty interesting. I mean, I kind of know, but mm-hmm. you just talk a little
sure.
bit about...
Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, thank you for the question. There are restrictions. I mean, obviously, there are a number of industries and a lot of types of work that miners can do. I mean, they're not restricted. And agriculture is one of those areas where there are less restrictions in agriculture, per se, than there are in some of the other industries. The major restrictions have to do with hazardous occupations. For example, there's certain kinds of work that the miners cannot do. And state law pretty much reflects federal law in that regard. They can't work with power-driven machinery in instances unless they're involved in some kind of apprenticeship-like program. Or there's certain kinds of work, in excavation or something like that, or involving explosives that they're not able to do. So there are the hazardous occupations which restrict what a miner can do in the workplace. Other kinds of restrictions are when they can work, whether it's in the school year or outside of the school year, and then the number of hours in each of those kinds of situations. The rules differ depending on the age of the minor. So the younger the minor, 14 and 15-year-old, the more restrictive it is. 16 and 17-year-olds, there are some restrictions, but less so because they're tending more to be like an adult employee. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, you kind of touched on the power tools. It's become kind of an issue around the firefighting and fire stuff from, like, the forest protection agencies and stuff have had to kind of change the way they're able to hire some of those 17-year-olds.
Okay. Okay. Representative Widener?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Also on the, basically the underage, has there ever been any discussion in the department of possibly implementing a training wage for people that are under the age of 18 to get them started, to encourage businesses to hire younger people in the summertime, things like that?
Madam Chair, Representative Widener, there hasn't been discussion within our division, but of course we're just enforcing, you know, the laws that are in place. That would require a statutory change, I imagine, to the law saying that there are circumstances in which an employer can employ someone at less than the statutory, say, minimum wage, or in a different kind of job than what the law is currently.
So you guys
require.
Just don't do that. You don't do that. You just go through and enforce what we have done.
Right. I mean, we do, of course, write rules interpreting what that may be. A second consideration, too, is that, as I mentioned a minute ago, we reflect federal law in many instances, and it might require federal changes as well as state changes to get something like that to happen.
Please continue.
So what I'd like to talk about next is the wage claim process that we have. As I mentioned, we receive about 2,000 plus wage claims per year that we investigate. The wage claim process begins with an employee filing a wage claim with the agency. We have a form that we make available to the public that can be filed with us. It can be filed through the mail, it can be filed at any of our offices. And in the form, the claimant is asked to identify him or herself, the employer, and basically information about what the situation is and what the nature of the claim is, why they feel that the employer has not paid them everything that they are entitled to. We do have some parameters around this. For example, as a matter of, you know, legal policy, or just a matter of resource policy, really, for the division, we set limits on the kinds of claims that we will receive. For example, you know, we want claims to be for current issues, so we don't accept a claim that's more than a year since the violation took place. We don't want to conduct investigations for incidents that may have happened, you know, years in the past. We also, you know, the claims have to be for work that was done in Oregon. I mean, there are Oregonians who say work outside of the state, in Washington, for example. We can't accept the claim for work in Washington because we don't have jurisdiction over that work. And there are other kinds of parameters or situations where we wouldn't accept a claim. But generally, you know, any person, any Oregonian who has performed work in Oregon can file a claim with the agency. The typical kinds of claims you receive are for unpaid final wages. You know, someone's employment is terminated for whatever reason. The person quit, or the person was fired, and the wages weren't paid in a timely manner. And so that person may file a wage claim with us. We receive claims for unpaid minimum wages or overtime. This may be someone claiming that the wages that they were paid were less than what the minimum standards are, and so they'll file a claim with us. Some claims have to do with unlawful deductions. This employee says, you know, I got my paycheck, a deduction was made for this. I don't think that's right. I don't think that's lawful, so they may file a claim. And then, as I mentioned, we have the Wage Security Fund, and some of the claims are claims for payouts from the Wage Security Fund. When an individual files a wage claim with the Wage and Hour Division, they actually sign what's called an assignment of wages, giving the Bureau basically ownership, you know, of those wages, so that we can go forward and collect those wages on their behalf if we find wages are owed, or we're in a position to settle that wage claim or somehow make an adjustment to that wage claim based on the information that we collect during an investigation. Recently, I happened to have cause to look at how we were doing as far as our investigations go, and we keep statistics as far as how long it takes for us to get through an investigation, and we have some performance measures around that activity. And about 75% of the investigations that we conduct are completed within 60 days of it being assigned to an investigator. To give a little context to that, the process basically is once a wage claim comes into us, it's screened by staff. They look to make sure that the wage claim is complete. Generally, at that point, there may be some communication with the wage claimant to get information that's missing, to ask the claimant to provide additional corroborating information that might help us understand what the claim is. So, for example, you know, copies of time records if they have them, copies of pay records, copies of the wage agreement or the work job description or something like that that will help us to understand what the claim is. Once that screening process is complete, if it looks like it's something that we cannot take, that is, we don't have jurisdiction for whatever reason, or it falls outside the policies of the kind of claim that we would accept, then we'll notify the claimant and say, you know, we can't take this claim for this reason. You know, you may wish to go to an attorney or to small claims court if you feel, you know, this is something that you need to take forward. If it's something that we can take, then what we do is send a notice of claim to the employer. And basically what that notice says is that, you know, an individual, and we identify the individual, has filed a claim against you for this amount of unpaid wages based on this wage rate for this period of time, and ask the employer to respond. The employer can either send payment of those wages if you know, upon reflection, it seems like the wages are owed, or the employer can respond and dispute the claim. If the employer wishes to dispute the claim, then we ask that the employer send in a formal response saying why the claim is being disputed, and then provide additional information. So if the employer's argument is that, well, I paid these wages, then they would submit evidence, you know, copies of paychecks, time records, so forth, to show that they have paid that employee properly. Again, if the employer responds, sends in payment, generally what will happen is we'll forward that payment on to the claimant, and then we'll close that claim. If the employer disputes the claim, or if the employer just disregards the notice and doesn't respond at all, then the claim will be assigned to an investigator. The investigator's responsibility basically is to weigh, you know, the evidence and the information provided, to apply the wage and hour laws and make a determination of whether or not it seems like there's substantial evidence that back wages are owed or not. And so in that process, oftentimes it's necessary for the investigator to communicate with both the claimant, the employer, the employer's representative, or other people who may have knowledge about information in that claim, whether that's witnesses or you know, maybe the employer's say bookkeeping or payroll company, or other persons who may have knowledge of the facts around the wage claim. Upon collecting that evidence, the compliance specialist, the investigator, decides that it doesn't appear that wages are owed, or that there's insufficient evidence to take a case forward to show that back wages are owed, then the case will be closed at that point and the claimant will be notified. If it appears that back wages are owed, or the evidence suggests that back wages are owed, then the investigator will communicate with the employer to try to collect those wages on a voluntary basis from the employer. So many of our cases settle at that point during the investigatory process.
Excuse me. Representative Holby.
Thank you. I just have a couple of questions, actually. So what happens in the case where instead of unlawful deductions, there's no deductions made, or somebody's being paid in cash? Mm-hmm. Being paid in cash, is that against the law in wages?
Madam Chair, Representative Holby, it is not against the law under wage and hour laws to pay an employee in cash, but you do have to give them an itemized statement saying this is how we calculated your wages. If you are making any deductions from that, what was earned, then you have to obviously identify that for the employee.
So is the lack of a wage statement then in a cash payment situation a law that is under Bowley's jurisdiction?
Or yes, it would be.
So, but the actual deductions, if they're incorrect, you know, or workers' comp, unemployment, if those are, do you make a determination whether those deductions are correct, or do you refer those cases to the other agencies as a matter of policy, I guess?
The wage and hour division would not make a determination about whether the amount of a deduction is correct or not, but if there's some dispute over that, then we would refer that on to whatever agency had jurisdiction over that issue. So mm-hmm. It could be workers' comp, it could be Department of Revenue, it could be Employment Department.
So your policy would be that when there's a dispute about that you would notify the other agency, or would you tell the person to notify the agency?
It depends on the circumstances. I mean, on an individual wage claim, I could see a compliance specialist saying, if a wage claimant brought this up, well, this is not really under our purview, but you may wish to bring this up to whatever agency it may be. If it seemed that this was a problem that was maybe systemic in a certain workplace, then we would likely make a referral to one of those agencies that, you know, that is an issue that they may wish to follow up on.
But nothing compels you to, I mean, is there any law that requires you to, I guess that's what I was getting at, is there any law that requires you to refer that type of dispute to the other agency? Or is it the burden of the person making the complaint to notify those other agencies?
I don't think that there's any law that compels us to do that, but certainly under the auspices of the Interagency Compliance Network, I mean, we are sharing information generally, and so when situations arise that we think rise to a certain level that we think this has interest for agencies outside our own, we certainly do make those kinds of referrals.
Another question, sir? You look like you have another question on your mind.
Yeah, no, that's okay.
Okay. Thank you. Please continue.
Okay. So, as I said, many of the wage claims then resolve themselves at the investigator level. The investigator is able to arrive at some kind of settlement between the parties, at which case, generally, the wage claim ends at that point. There are cases, however, where a compliance specialist cannot arrive at a settlement with the parties. You know, the employer feels that despite the compliance specialist determination that wages aren't owed and wishes to challenge that determination. In cases like that, the agency issues what's called an order of determination. It's a legal order that's served on an employer that says the Bureau has investigated this matter, finds that this claimant is owed this amount of money for under these circumstances for this period of time, and the order gives the employer the opportunity to request either a hearing or a court trial in response to the order. So within a certain period of time, the employer can respond to the agency to say, you know, I continue to dispute that I owe any wages, and I wish to either have a hearing, an administrative hearing, which happens through the agency, or I wish to have a trial in a court of law, in which case the agency would refer the matter to the Department of Justice to file a complaint in court, and then it goes through the court process. I would say that of the responses or answers that we get to our orders of determination, the majority are for administrative hearings, and those are heard before an administrative law judge. It's something similar to a court proceeding, but it's much more informal than you might see in a court. The administrative law judge will hear both sides, and if in that case a claimant would be represented by the agency's case presenter. The employer may represent himself, may hire an attorney to represent him, or have some other authorized representative at the hearing. The ALJ will issue a proposed order after the hearing. Both sides can file exceptions to that proposed order if they desire to do so. Once a final order comes out, which is signed off by the commissioner, any party has the right to appeal that decision to the Oregon Court of Appeals. In cases where the Bureau does obtain a judgment for unpaid wages against an employer, which might be a default judgment if the employer didn't respond to the order of determination, or maybe a case that has gone through the hearings process, we send those to the Department of Revenue for collection.
Sorry to keep dragging this out, but another question. Yeah. Does the agency have the authority to overturn the final order in this case?
Madam Chair, Representative Holby, the agency to overturn the final order?
Uh-huh.
So the final...
So the final order comes out. Does Boley have the ability to say, no, we don't agree with that final order, we're going to issue our own?
Well, the final order... is of course written up by the administrative law judge, but is signed by the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor. So the commissioner is in fact the one that's issuing the final order, so that would be the agency's final order.
I think the question is does the commissioner ever not sign that final order?
I think
is that kind of the idea? That's kind of an overturning.
Slightly, or they will change the final order. Does he have the authority?
He has the authority to do that.
That was my question.
I can't tell you how often that has happened, but yes.
Probably very rarely, but I'm just curious. Some agencies have that authority.
Other agencies do it not infrequently.
Yeah, I mean, some agencies do it frequently, some agencies don't. Some agencies have that authority and some agencies don't.
Right. So I think the commissioner has that authority. I think he probably rarely exercises that authority. I mean, by the time it reaches him, it has gone through a hearing. Mm-hmm. An ALJ has made a decision. The record of our hearings is very thorough. I mean, all the facts are listed, opinions are listed in there. There's this case discussion. So, I don't think it happens very often, but I believe he can. Yes.
I can't imagine the Commissioner of Vakian or any commissioner would reverse an ALJ's findings on a wage claim. You know what I mean?
Well,
it's probably
happen,
not a wage
claim.
It would be...
Not wise.
I bet he's never done it.
So, okay.
So, the collection would be then the last stage of the wage claim process. I think that, in a nutshell, is what we do when we receive a claim, investigate a claim, and how we arrive at decisions. I'm happy to answer any more questions that you may have if there's some specifics that you'd like to know about that process that I can answer.
I do have a question. Do you have the ability to impose penalties in the wage claim against the employer?
Madam Chair, yes, we can. In fact, perhaps what I should have mentioned during the investigative process is that usually during investigation, when it settles, we're settling for just wages.
Mm-hmm.
The law provides for penalties that a wage claimant can receive if wages aren't paid properly or aren't paid timely. Generally, we do not pursue those penalties. If we are able to settle it for just the wages with the employer during the investigation, that changes. If we have to litigate the matter, mm-hmm. then that order of determination will identify not only the wages that we find are owed, but also any penalties which the employer may owe the wage claimant because of the lack of a timely payment. In addition to that, when we conduct an investigation, sometimes we find violations of other laws which may not be for penalties that go to wage claimants, but maybe penalties related to working conditions or record keeping requirements. In those cases, it could be tied to a wage claim, but we might also serve a notice of an intent to assess civil penalties for those kinds of violations. So if in investigating a wage claim we find, for example, that an employer didn't keep the kinds of records that needed to be kept, and that made it very difficult for us to be able to ascertain, you know, hours worked or something like that, that penalty also might become part of that process.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Very informative. Oh, excuse me. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to thank you and your staff. We recently had a situation with one of my constituents, which also happened to be my daughter, who had gone to work.
Wait, did she vote for you?
She said she did. I didn't see a ballot. Supposed to be there.
Yes, yes.
There was a situation where she'd went to work for a coffee company there in Monmouth. She's going to school and worked for several days, and it wasn't a good fit for her. And they claimed it was just training time and weren't going to pay her. So you guys are really good about answering that question, and we're working through that process. But you got back to us rather quickly, and I do appreciate it.
Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, that those are some of the most satisfying kinds of situations that we have in the division, where we're actually able to respond and hopefully to gain compliance without having to go through, you know, an investigation and the hearings process.
Because I know this committee has had quite a bit of concern and discussion and stuff over the people who are being paid under the table, mm-hmm. You know, day workers, day laborers who are not paid at all. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of fear and so on around that. And I'm sure that that's something that we'll be able to still go through, and I think we're still going to be going through and talking about that. But that's one area that is of great concern. You know, when you pick somebody up off the street corner and say, mm-hmm. we're going to pay you this much, and they don't pay yeah. them at all.
So. Yeah. Madam Chair, I appreciate that those kinds of situations, and we are reaching out. We do reach out to various groups in the community to try to, you know, address that, to see if there are ways or what role that the wage in our division can play to resolve those kinds of situations.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Anything else? Okay, thank you very much for your informative information. Okay, with that, the only thing we have left, we've got some committee bills that probably will be pending. I think we still have maybe one slot left for committee bills. There's, I think we're so far a committee bill on pawn shops and some tweaking to that, and possibly a committee bill. I need to talk to a representative from Curry County to talk about business-to-business unfair trade right. practice. And but other than that, we've got... We had one other, didn't we?
It was going to be a committee issue, but not a committee bill.
Oh, okay. So anyway, so that's what we got so far, and that's it. Any other questions, comments, concerns?
Less is more.
Okay, that's right. Okay, committee adjourned. Oh, hey, could you? Committee adjourned. Oh, hey, could you?